Johnson. Hi, how are you? Who are you?
Elise, I just added this box.
Okay. All right, David, what's your last name?
A-Y-O-O-L-A.
Okay, thank you. And what's your name?
Elise Rose.
Both of you added today? Or were you on the roster and you just weren't here on Thursday?
Yeah, I wasn't on it. I wasn't here on Thursday, but I was already on the roster.
I was not on the roster.
Okay, so you got added and you weren't. And who are you, sir?
We need your air camera.
All right, you were here.
Yeah.
You got the window seat. It'll be chilly today, that's for sure. All right. So, 1, 2, 3 people are not here. Those of you who are not here, please write this down. I'm gonna give you a URL I want you to write down, put in your notes. You ready, David?
Yeah.
Here we go. PROFLIMANEK.com. PROFLIMANEK. I'm giving you that because I record all the classes, so you have the ability to go and listen to what you missed on Thursday. So we will be all caught up. And I also explain what's on the website. I explain the grades and everything that's involved in this class. And it was already posted for you, so you have the ability to catch up like that. You, sir, right there. What's your name?
Chase Owen. I'm Chase.
You were here.
Yeah.
You were over there. Someone's there now. So you're over there. That works. With authority. Your name, sir?
Kieran.
You were here. And you're back. Did you have a nice weekend?
Yeah, it was good.
Excellent. All right, I think I got everybody. Oh, wait, you, sir. The Rose Bowl hat.
Caden.
All right, you were here.
Yeah.
And you were there on Thursday, too.
Sir.
All right, so for the new people, just try to stay where you are, because I don't know who you are, and I don't really have assigned seats, but I have your name down, and that's how I'm going to put your face with your name. So just don't kind of rope around. I mean, you don't have a big room anyway, so. All right. Let's see if we got other light comers, but it is what it is. All right, so we started kind of dealing with what was going on in Europe at around the time when we're supposed to start, 1500. And we know that change was brewing. Everything that was going on and had been in place in Europe for hundreds of years was coming to an end because of events that were occurring. Yes, you still had the same social structure. What class was at the top? What do we call them? The nobles, who were kind of like in the middle. Okay, and who was down on the bottom? Peasants, all right. There we go, commoners, peasants. That's kind of the way society was structured, had been, still was. But again, change was coming because the people at the bottom started getting money. And as they got money, they wanted to get promoted, have more influence, have more rights, have better positions. We also know that at 1500, everyone was kind of the same religiously in Europe. They were members of what church or what denomination?
Catholics.
There you go. So the popes had lots of power. But of course, we know that the papacy had gotten itself into problems over the couple of hundred years before. a little bit of corruption, bad calls on things like the Crusades. You actually had a king go kill a pope, you know. So the church was kind of losing its grip, which suddenly meant there was a vacuum that was being created. Because the people who had been in charge were now being shoved aside, which gave opportunity for others to rise up and to take their positions. You also had the Renaissance. They started thinking differently. They started viewing the world around them differently. And one of the biggest change was the motivation for this stuff. Any of you not like money? Because if you suddenly don't like money, I will gladly take yours. I am a charity unto myself, and I will spend it wisely. So what was the easiest way to make money? Well, to get something that people wanted. And the one thing that people wanted, generally speaking, were those fancy items that only could be found on the other side of the earth. The spices, the silks, the luxury items, which had been going to Europe for hundreds of years. I don't know if any of you know this, but Rome made its first trade agreement with China in and around 100 AD. So goods had been flowing slowly by land, but that changed because of the rise of those Muslim empires that we talked about. It kind of shut everything down. So the Europeans wanted the stuff. They knew they could make money on it, but they couldn't get it. So for the first time, they were going to use the technological advances that they had. Better boats that could sail globally, and they were going to get the stuff, because if they got the stuff, they could make money, and if they got the money, they could become wealthy. All right, that's pretty much all we covered. 1500 is the time of change. The biggest change was those in power. The kings. The kings no longer could be checked by the church, the papacy. Previously, generally speaking, not always, but in many cases, the kings asked the popes for permission to do anything. To go to war, to get married, to get divorced. And they did not move unless the pope said, go ahead. But by 1500, a lot of the kings were like, who cares about that pope guy? They also began dreaming of putting the political check in its place. Because the pope was at the top, but was being shoved aside. But the thing that kept the king from rising was the nobles. Now, technically the king was a noble. And technically the king's family was a noble family. And the only thing that separated the king's noble family from all of the other noble families was that all of the nobles accepted one of their own to kind of be like the top family in charge. Well, by and around the 16th century, the 1500s, the kings began saying, yeah, let's not shove all of these knuckleheads out of my way, which means the king could get more. More. And ultimately, that was the biggest driving motivation for change. What did the kings want more of? Well, to put the nobles in their place, the kings had to get more power. They had to have the ability to have larger armies that were more effective, more lethal, so they could dominate those around them. Well, the only way to get a big army is you need more money. Because you got to hire the soldiers. You got to give them wages. You got to give them arms. You have to feed them, clothe them, train them. It takes money. Well, the biggest problem was is the economy was still largely agrarian. And that's the first thing I'm going to throw out for the day. What is agrarian economies? Does anyone know what that is?
An economy run by agriculture.
How?
It's all like the peasants work the fields, and yeah, they harvest the crops, and then the people who are in charge of them get the money off of it. trade this?
Well, do they necessarily get money by trading the word you use their goods?
No, it's like a good word for like, I'll give you food, you give me like clothes or whatever it is.
Barter for exchange.
You produce something in surplus, and you trade with me something that I have in surplus. Obviously, if you're bartering and trading and you want large quantities of food, that means you need large quantities of real estate. So the kings realized the only way they could get more powerful is if they got more land. Is there a problem with that?
They didn't own it, yeah.
Oh, yeah, if they didn't own it. Can you make more land? Do you think there was even one square foot of open real estate anywhere in Europe?
No. All of the land was occupied. So how are you going to get more? Well, it could be costly. It could involve lots of violence. It could be destructive. But if you attempt to, say, commit a genocide on all your nobles, chances are they're going to kind of unite and overthrow you. So again, it's not an easy thing to do. But is there opportunity elsewhere? Where?
America! It's a big blue world, is it not? All right. And this is how the modern world essentially would come into existence. This desire for the kings to get more would trigger an economic revolution. And the agrarian economies began giving way to mercantilist economies. Does anyone know that word? Mercantilism. It's kind of in the name.
Sellers.
What?
People who sell things.
Merchants.
Right.
Yeah. So what the king stopped worrying about was getting more acreage and started focusing on just getting more stuff. Because if the kings could get their hands on more stuff, they could essentially start doing those exchanges in a way that potentially could be more profitable. So you would have to get it from somewhere else. Like it. Now, in many ways, mercantilism, to a degree, is similar to our economic system, capitalism. But there's a huge difference. In that, in a mercantilist economy, it's the crown that controls everything. And the decisions are made for the benefit of the crown. Capitalism, decisions are made for the benefit of the owner of the company or the business. They're the ones who set the prices. They're the ones who control the profit margin. They're the ones who determine what's going to be bought and sold, who's hired, who's fired. Mercantilism is the crown. Questions so far? All right. Well, what would begin to happen? And again, there was different variations of it based on which country you're talking about. But the Western European countries began going global and basically building empire. Oh, here's a little side question. What's the difference between an empire and a kingdom? We'll start off with kingdom first. What's a kingdom?
Run by sovereigns.
Okay, well, isn't an emperor also a sovereign?
No.
No?
No.
What's the difference?
Family, heritage, lineage.
Well, then how do you become an emperor?
Pardon me?
How do you become an emperor?
By the people, right? No?
You have to be born into it, so you have to come from a certain family to get that position.
Kings, like England.
Right.
You become a king, and then your daughter or a son, you become queen or prince.
Well, that's true. So you get to be the head of state in a kingdom by basically coming from a family, and you're ruling over in a kingdom. Who are you sovereign over? Who are you ruling?
People.
Which people, though?
People living within your country.
Okay, so people in your own country.
Right.
That's good. So chances are same culture, same ethnic group, same tradition, same religion, language, and so forth. How's that different from an empire?
What's an empire?
Yeah. Everything's different in an empire.
I agree with you 100%, but what's the difference?
So, majority of the time, empires normally invade, take over other cultures, and they all become one.
Oh! So, could we say that an empire is a kingdom that essentially went and conquered other kingdoms? So the population isn't like a kingdom where they're all the same. Population of empire are different cultural groups ruled over by one. Oh.
Like Napoleon.
Like Napoleon. All right. Or Rome. Or the Mongol Empire. Something like that. British Empire. All right. Mercantilism. The crown, and we just kind of let the cat out of the bag. The crown authorizes his soldiers not to conquer his own people, but to go elsewhere and conquer others, to subvert them, to bring them into the system to produce goods for the whole. The easiest way to think about it is you have the core, which we shall call the motherland, and then all of the parts that are conquered, generally referred to as colonies. Or protectorates, or there's a whole bunch of terms you can use. We'll make it simple. Now, sometimes the colonists are people from the motherland that went over and lived in the new lands. But sometimes the colonists are people who are conquered. And they're being used for one purpose. To produce. To produce goods, resources, not available in the home country.
Excuse me, the pilgrims were sent to America?
100%. They had a contract with the London Company to come over to what was then technically Northern Virginia, because the whole coast was Virginia, and they were obligated to pay back the costs to the London Company to produce something of value and basically work as employees of the company. Uh-huh. The interesting thing about the pilgrims, though, is out of all, because all of the British colonies in North America were founded that way, it was only the pilgrims who managed to pay the debt. They harvest enough cod and produced enough lumber that they basically bought out their contract.
Wow.
Yeah. They were hard workers. All right, so mercantilism, colonies produce things, wood, tea, sugar, cotton, tobacco, whatever product that was desired, that was worth something, that wasn't grown in the home country. Initially, there was lots of vegetables, things like the potatoes and tomatoes that were not native to Europe, that were grown in the colonies, harvested in mass, sent back, and then they were dealt with. And how were they dealt with? Well, a lot of it was made into other things. So we'll keep wood as the example. Obviously, Europe had been highly civilized for hundreds of years. Lots of the forests had been cut down. But yet they come over to North America, Central America, South America, and there are trees in abundance. So they began harvesting lumber, putting it on boats, and sending it back. In fact, you may not know this, there was actually a point about 200 years ago when there was almost no trees in Massachusetts. All the trees were cut down. And then the trees started growing, and then there was a major blight in like the 1850s. And then all the trees died again. So that's the reason why in Massachusetts there aren't many old growth trees. Because they were either cut down or they died. All right, but anyways, so you take the wood, you send it back, and that's what the crown wants. The crown doesn't want the colonies making anything. No. Because they're going to buy the resources with the stuff that gets processed. And thus you have this self-contained monopoly. Colonies produce what the crown wants. They sell everything to the crown. In the people in the home country, they're going to make the stuff into items, and they're going to sell it to the colonies. Colonies can only buy from the mother country. Self-contained monopoly.
Wow.
All right. Now there's a catch. How do you make sure the people in the colonies are behaving? And how do you protect your colonists from other mercantile empires? Or even worse, those filthy, savage heathens that live in the jungles that are going to come out and kill everybody. Well, the obligation of the crown also is not only to govern the colonies, but also to protect them. And why is the crown doing it? Well, the crown is doing it so it can tax everything. Oh, go back. What is going on? I am failing with clickers. There you go. Money! Under, for example, the laws of England, all the regulations are known as the Navigation Acts. Under the Crown of England, every good that was produced over here had to go on a boat that was owned by a citizen of the empire, and it only could be shipped to England. And once it arrived in, say, London Harbor, the tax man cometh. He would go down on the boat, he would look at the manifest, and he would assess taxes on everything that came off the boat. Oh, and by the way, when the captain was ready to fill up the boat and bring stuff back to the colonies, the taxman met the ship captain again and taxed everything that went on the boat. Now, the taxes were not high, nothing like what we're being taxed to oblivion in our modern society. Maybe 5, 10, 15%. But these taxes, or duties as they were formerly known as, were all collected here, and this is what paid for the system. So obviously the king wanted the colonies producing more, because that meant more goods coming in getting taxed. And those goods had to be bought with something, which meant more goods were going out, which meant more taxes. A lot easier than owning hundreds and hundreds of acres of land, no? Mercantilism. Now, by the way, Spain, France, Portugal, England, the Netherlands, they all kind of did the same thing. They all just did it different. So we don't have the time to talk about every single mercantilist system. We don't. So if you can just kind of remember the gist, the basics, we'll be fine. And everything else will make sense. All right? All right, here we go. Who's...
I have a quick question.
Sure.
Is that why the Netherlands still own the islands off of South America?
Yes.
Get out.
Yep.
Because of the oil and the oil.
Well, the Netherlands owned, like, Indonesia up until the 1960s.
Wow.
England owned India until the 1950s, you know.
Wow.
All of it dates back to around 1500 when they first came over.
Wow.
Any other questions? By the way, don't, for those of you who weren't here, I think I said it to the group on Thursday. If you have a question, stop me. Ask. I'm not afraid of questions. I like questions. All right. Now, the first two nations to get a jump on things were ideally located, already out in the Atlantic Ocean.
Wow.
Portugal and Spain. Now, if you go back and have the ability to read the primary sources, the reasons why these countries started doing this mercantilist stuff was the same, as I've already explained to you. They were angry that those land routes from Asia had been cut off by the Muslim empires, the Ottomans, the Safavids, the Mughals. And so they wanted to get it. But they knew they couldn't go by land. So they were determined to go by sea. Now here's the catch. How do you do it? Well, at the time, I bet this is a touch screen. Cannot touch the screen. All right, stop. Work with me.
down to about here. This was about the end of the world that the Spanish and the Portuguese knew. Why? Well, there was plenty of stories of people sailing through the Mediterranean, and they knew that there was water here. They knew this was land. They just didn't know what was kind of beyond the horizon. They also knew what was up here. And, I was trying to get the red. They also knew what was here, and they knew they could not go this way. So this left them to engage in a fateful decision. Do I go north? Well, if I go north, we know it's cold up there. We also know that they are very violent people, particularly the Russians. So if we try going north to get to there, we're probably going to get killed. We could go this way, but we have no idea what's out there. So, what happens if we try going this way? Figuring out how big this is, because eventually, all land masses, you can get around them. It's just a matter of how far you're going to travel. What is going on? Oh, man. And ironically, it was the Portuguese who went first. They took off about 80 years before the Spanish did. All right. What motivated this attempt to get around Africa, ironically, was an idea thought up of by the son of the king. Prince Henry, third son of the King of Portugal, King John I, had a wonderful idea. See, what the story about how he got the idea is also kind of interesting. I'll start off with that before I give you the idea. Back then, typically, the king wanted lots of sons so he could have a big bench in the event that something happened. The firstborn, usually, if he lives, is going to become what?
King.
King dies, the oldest son takes over. What's the job of the second kid? Second son, to be precise. You know what his job is? No. Have a heartbeat.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. Why do we think we have a vice president? Because life was crazy back then. Life expectancy was really short. So if something happened to the firstborn, you got secondborn on deck.
Wow.
Guess what the job of the thirdborn was? Well, kind of. But you're not necessarily as important as the second son. So your chances of becoming king are kind of remote. So what are you going to do?
Children.
Well, some might want to have children, right? Kind of go off and do their own thing.
Be married and move to America.
Well, not quite yet, because we don't know America's there. No spoilers. We're talking 1410, after all.
All right.
Typically, what happened to the third son is the father would buy him a seat in the church. And typically, they would become either a bishop or a cardinal. Because if you had enough money, you could buy any position in the church. You've already said the church was kind of corrupt back then. Well, as it turns out, Prince Henry was not really spiritual, but he had a clever mind for business. So he came up with an idea, and he put the proposal before his father, and his father essentially said no. He said, well, Dad, what happens if we buy a bunch of these ships that the Venetians are building and see if we can get around the Muslim empires and see if we can go directly to India or China? The king was like, man, that's a lot of risk. Because again, at the time, what did they know? They knew about like this. There could be bad things south of what they knew. And if you spend a lot of money and you buy the ships and you hire the crew and something happens in the middle of the ocean, say, you just lost all your money. So the prince said, fine. He decided to do it himself.
came up with an idea.
He would buy the ships. He would, out of his own bank account, hire the ship captains and the crew. And those brave enough to go on board on these expeditions would get a cut of the profit. The term, Henry gets 20% of whatever you get. And the rest is split by the crew and the captain. Not a bad deal. Not a bad deal.
So what has he began doing? Well, over the next 50 years of his life, he began hiring crews and ships and captains, and they slowly started sailing on kind of like little back and forth expeditions, slowly pushing their knowledge of what was out there, but never going too far because of the fear. If they go too far, you run out of fresh water, you run out of food, or God forbid, you're in the middle of the ocean and your boat goes. So they never really pushed it far, but by the first 50 years, they managed to get down almost to the Congo River, which is down there. They also laid claim to some of the islands, such as the Canary Islands, that are off the coast of Africa, because no one else was there. They claimed them for their own. And they also made contacts with powerful African chieftains, who ironically were doing the same things as the European kings. They wanted to get more and more and more as well. So everything was going great, except the Africans really didn't have anything major in terms of resources that the Portuguese really wanted. So the profit was at a minimum. Unfortunately for Prince Henry, by the time he died, he was at about the break-even point. He probably lost a little money over the course of the 40 or 50-odd years. But he didn't really strike it rich. But what he did was manage to get the Portuguese claims all the way down to around there. Well, this idea was revived by his nephew, who would be crowned John II. Except instead of having a prince do this, now the crown would do it. Because the crown started seeing the profitability, or at least potential. Over the next 20 years, the Portuguese continued to go south, mile by mile, until in 1488, Bartolomeu Dias got around the southern tip of Africa and noted in his account the coast is now starting to go northerly. He proclaimed that southern tip the Cape of Good Hope. This makes him and his crew technically the first Europeans to get around Africa, to circumnavigate. Wow. Questions?
Cape Indians, that's why they're Portuguese and still live there.
Huh?
Wow. What? They don't move. I mean, it's amazing.
Huh? Now, here's the funny thing. This was huge because this was proof positive that Western Christendom did not have to launch another series of crusades. They did not have to go to war with Islam. They just simply go around them. Here's another interesting factoid. All of the kings in their courts had one thing in common. They all had ambassadors. And in every single court, there was representatives of every other monarch in Europe. So the moment one thing happened in one country, everybody knew it. So at the same point, word comes back to Lisbon. We got around Africa. All of the other monarchs have their ambassadors hear this. And guess what they start thinking?
The first one to jump was Spain.
they decide that they can't go south now because Portugal has that claim. And if they go south, that means war. And by the way, the Pope would not bless a war between the two wealthiest, potentially now because of this expedition stuff, Catholic countries. So then Spain started scratching their head saying, well, maybe we should go north. But again, those Russians are up there. In comes a bold Italian, Cristobal Colombo, with an interesting idea. See, he managed to, based on the expeditions and all that was learned by the Portuguese, and based on all of the knowledge that the Europeans had of the world, going all the way back to one of the most famous books of the medieval period, The Adventures of Marco Polo. They had all of this description. They had all of the distances, all estimated. And there were cartographers that started making maps. This, ironically, was the map that Columbus presented to Ferdinand and Isabella. He's like, look, your majesties, we can't go this way, we can't go this way, so why don't we go this way? According to what we know, when Columbus presented this plan, the Spanish monarchs were kind of like, because they had just finished a series of wars that stretched back 300 years, called the Reconquista. It's when the Spanish Catholics not only drove the Muslims out of the Iberian Peninsula, but they also would do the same thing to many of the Jews that lived there. So they had already experienced a lot of loss. They already incurred a lot of expenses. And to be honest with you, they just saw this as, we're going to put guys in a box, we're going to spend for it, they're going to go out to the ocean, they're going to sink. But Columbus was confident. He believed, when he presented to the king and queen, that he could get to map, Japagnu in 33 days. Japagnu is what Marco Polo called Japan.
33 days? Where the heck did he get this?
Well, first up, we got to deal with a couple of things. First up, he made a couple of mistakes. But before we talk about his mistakes, we have to despoil something. No one at the time thought the world was flat. That is a big lie that has come down in the last 160 years of history. Any of you ever heard of a guy by the name of Washington Irving? What book is he famous for writing? What story? Do you know? Two books, very popular. One was a story about a guy who kind of fell asleep outside under a tree and slept for many, 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 many years.
Oh my.
Rip Van Winkle?
Yeah.
And also talked about a story that dastardly took place in a small village in New York called Sleepy Hollow. Well, before he started writing those types of stories, he wrote his first book, which was a biography of Christopher Columbus. And he decided to add a little spin to the book so it could make Columbus seem like more of an extraordinary figure. So, in this biography, it was Irving who first made the claim that it was only Columbus who was brave enough to sail west, because everyone else thought the world was flat. Why? Because they were looking at a map. Any of you ever look at a map? Not the maps on your phone. It's like a map. You open it up, kind of look at it down at the table. Boy, it must be flat then. It was a good spin. Sold lots of books. But that lie kind of got stuck
into the minds of history, which is kind of bizarre. Truth be told, everyone going all the way back to the ancient Greeks knew the world was round. But the one thing they didn't know, and this is part of the mistakes that Columbus made, was they just didn't know how big the earth was. Although the Greeks, ironically, calculated it perfectly. All right, mistake number one. Columbus's calculations were based on using distances developed by an ancient Persian geographer, a man by the name of Alfraganus. You don't have to remember his name. Alfraganus essentially said that 1 degree latitude, you know, you're figuring the circumference of a circle, you do latitude, degrees latitude, was 56.67 miles. Even though it's actually 68.7 miles. So you're off roughly, 15% for every degree? Well, Columbus ended up with an Earth that was roughly 25% smaller at its circumference than the Earth actually is. So if you have less distance to travel, you're going to get there quicker, no? That's mistake number one. Mistake number two, he used Marco Polo's measurements for the size of Asia. And based on what, as Marco Polo had it laid out, Japan was 8,000 miles closer to Europe. Which would make it closer to Europe than even North America is. So that's the reason why he was absolutely convinced. His math was wrong. So there's a lesson. Figure out how to do math before you plan a big trip. Just kind of saying. All right, questions? All right, long story short, as we know, Columbus would take off. He would make 4 voyages. He would first arrive, what year? 1492, in October, by the way. It's believed that he first discovered the Bahamas, and in his accounts, he was absolutely convinced that that was Japan. And then he continued, he explored what is now apparently by executive order, the Gulf of America. Landed in San Salvador. He established the first colony in the New World. And he was absolutely convinced that he was in the Indies, Indonesia, Philadelphia, the Philippines. You know, the islands. Because the accounts that he had read from Marco Polo or what the islanders look like in the Pacific were identical to these islanders he came across. Initially, he had pretty good relations with the Tiano people. They were pretty friendly. Although, interestingly enough, Columbus was amazed their naivete and their willingness to do anything, including some extracurriculars between the crew and the ladies. As he described it, they never said no. And what did he call them? Indios. Indios. To translate it loosely, close to God. Which is the origin of the word that we have today is Indians. Close to God, meaning they're not with God, but they're kind of close to God. They could be God or become Christians. Now, of course, we know the stories. Columbus would take several back, brought them back as kind of curiosities. He would, based on the values of the day, he would cause a lot of destruction in the Caribbean. But I suppose to a degree the Indians were, the Native Americans were able to get them back because they did share venereal disease. A lot of the VD that still plagues Europe today actually came from them. So I guess destroy a civilization, spread a disease, you know, it's kind of
All right, anyways. He would make 4 trips total. He would die penniless, absolutely convinced he was in the Pacific. Absolutely convinced. But now we have a problem, because the Portuguese are able to get around Africa, and they're going to go to Asia, and now the Spanish are going to go to Asia, and what potentially could happen between these competing kingdoms looking to get more and more and more? Well, there could be war. So, knowing this to be true, the Pope, of all people, intervenes. Pope Alexander VI, who, FYI, is the Borgia Pope. You know that name. One of the most corrupt popes in the history of the church. He decides he will lose too much money if Spain and Portugal go to war. Because if the two countries are warring, where will they not give their money to? Church. So what he decides to do is he's going to bring them together and he's going to come out a compromise. And the compromise is known as the Treaty of Torcedia. In this treaty, King John II of Portugal and Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain will essentially agree to split the earth in two. They will take the globe and they will divide it roughly at 32 degrees 53 minutes west latitude. This line, which of course, because it's a globe, also goes on the back. So thinking that this is there, it makes sense. Because the Pope is going to grant to Portugal its right and give him India. But to Spain, he is going to give to Spain their way and essentially give them China and Japan.
Wow.
Split the difference. Go make lots of money and give lots back to the church. Question. All right. Now we know what they're doing. We know where they're going. We know why they're doing it. More, more, more. How they did it is different. Both literally and figuratively, in making their mercantilist empires, Spain and Portugal took different paths. The most famous, and it's stuff you probably have already learned about, was how the Spanish did it. The Spanish essentially decided they were going to conquer this territory that Columbus discovered for them. Fueled by the Reconquistas, Spain would send over warriors with orders to carry forth the cross and to subvert all that they came in contact with, to bring them into a Spanish empire. Now, FYI, going back to the time of Crusades, there was a papal bull that was still in effect, and it was Terra Nulla, or Terra Nullius, to use church Latin. Loosely translates to no man's land or nobody's land. Under the law of the Catholic Church, the only people who could legally own land were Catholics. This is how Pope Urban II and all of the other popes that came after managed to get the knights to rise up in Europe and travel to the Middle East to go and conquer. So basically, you kill them all and you take their stuff. Well, that was still the rules on the books. Fast forward 400 years. So as the conquistas went, they were adhering to the law of the church. Thus, it was right for them to conquer, take their land, which would then produce goods
for the benefit of the crown and the church. All right, to make it simple, the launch pad was the first base of operations which Columbus founded in his second expedition. It all started from Hispaniola. Anyone know what two countries are on Hispaniola today? Haiti and?
The DR.
Yep. So it all started from here, and then over the next years and decades, expedition after expedition essentially fanned out throughout the Caribbean. I'll do it that way. I don't want to do politics. Cuba was seized, colonized, Puerto Rico, all of the other islands. Eventually, by 1510, look, just 20 years, they had penetrated so far, they began landing on the Yucatan Peninsula. And upon landing on the Yucatan, they started hearing stories of magnificent cities in which the gold flowed like water. But the stories of these conquistadors and their letters still survive. And their descriptions of these native people they came in contact with were nothing like the way Marco Polo described the Chinese or the Indians or even the Japanese. So they were kind of confused. By this point, Columbus was dead. But Columbus was absolutely convinced he'd gotten to the Pacific. Does anyone know who figured out what it was Columbus actually discovered? Another explorer, Ferdinand Magellan. So by 1520, the Spanish, kind of like the Portuguese, were trying to go a little up. I mean, by this point, they had already had landed in Florida, St. Augustine. They were building a fort there. They were already starting to go down the southern tip of South America. They'd already kind of like rimmed, you know, the Mexican and southern United States boundaries. They were still believing this was just part of Asia. Or, if it's not, it just must be an island. So we must be able to get around it. Well, the first person to do so was Magellan. You can see on the red. He would literally circumnavigate the globe. He launched 1520. He managed to get down to the southern tip of South America, which he called Cape Horn. In November, hit violent storms, lost a couple of ships, many of his crew, but eventually got around it and continued through the Pacific, touching upon some of the small little Pacific islands that are out there. Whenever they could, they got fresh water, fresh wood. But eventually, they would make it to the Philippines. And in the Philippines, he got himself into a little trouble. So in the Philippines, there was a battle of civilization going on. Islam had penetrated some of the islands coming from Indonesia. But there were many islands in the Philippines that were still pagan. There was this one island called Lapu-Lapu, that the people on the other islands basically avoided for a reason. But Magellan didn't realize that. So he landed, and he sought to have a meeting with their chief, Datu Lapu-Lapu, in hopes of building an alliance of friendship. Well, Datu Lapu-Lapu was kind of like, I don't really like outsiders. Then Magellan made a huge mistake and said, my friend, why don't you embrace the good book? Why don't you join the church and be saved by the teachings of Jesus Christ? Which apparently Datu Lapu-Lapu took huge offense at. So much so, he ordered a war party to attack Magellan and his sailors.
some of which managed to get on the little dinghies, the little rowboats, and row back out to the ships. But unfortunately, Magellan did not get that far. Because the people of the island used poison darts.
And apparently, Magellan got hit in the back by a couple, which allowed some of the warriors to come up and basically club him, probably shattering his spine. He went over, and the last that the crew saw of their captain, a bunch of others were coming in with stone axes and hacking at his body. He would be dinner, because the people of the island were cannibals.
But nonetheless, of the 235 men that left, of the five ships that departed, 18 managed to survive on one boat. They would return nearly a year later, and they basically had the story of all ages. We sailed around the earth. We know not only how big the earth is, hence Columbus was wrong, but we also know that these are not islands. This is not Asia. These are new continents. So, man, what a gift Columbus actually gave to the Spanish.
The continent, people who lived there know it was that big themselves?
No.
They never traveled any farther than home.
The average distance that human beings traveled up until probably the 19th or 20th century was probably no more than 10, maybe 20 miles tops from where they were born. So I'm sure if you were in a tribe that was close to the coast, you knew there was lots of water there. But there's no way you ever traveled the other way. What a gift it was. Other questions? Well, in terms of civilizations, the tribes that were out on the islands were not really major civilizations. They were primitive, tribal, just beyond Stone Age in terms of their technology and their cultures. But once they penetrated the Yucatan Peninsula, the Spanish got word of a highly advanced, highly powerful civilization. Individuals that today we refer to as the Aztecs. Now, I'm going to warn you, this is one of the challenges of history. Obviously, I'm telling little stories, I'm adding little twists and turns to keep it interesting. But the factual basis for any history is biased. It's biased by the people who wrote it. So the information that I've been sharing obviously is biased because it's coming from the Spaniards. And the same is true here. So some of what I'm going to tell you may not actually be the way it was. But the problem is the Aztecs didn't have writing used to tell stories. So we don't know how accurate it was. But I'll give you the best I can give you. All right. First off, the people we call Aztecs, they called themselves Mexica. Aztecs was the label that the Spanish put on them. Mexica, apparently, was their word for the people. Which, coincidentally, is usually how any civilization defines themselves. They're the people and everyone else is not. By the time the Spanish arrived, they had an empire. They were one tribal group that through conquest and alliances managed to conquer dozens of other groups and stitch together an imperial system in which their people were the rulers and everybody else was below them. The job of the empire was to provide goods for
the rulers. The heart, well, I'll go back. There we go. I'll give you the spelling and then I'll go back and I'll show you the map.
The heart of the empire was their capital city.
Tenochtitlan. Tenochtitlan, coincidentally, at the time of the arrival of the Spanish, was the most populous city in the New World. It's believed at its height, it had as many as 350,000 people living there. So we're talking men, women, children of all ages, all interests, all attitudes, multiple professions, diverse in their uniqueness. But if I could, I'm going to go back to the map. One of the most striking features was the fact that the city was actually built in the middle of a lake. This was the ultimate defense measure. Because the only way their enemies could get to them was either by boat, which of course they could see, or by one of huge land bridges, which they could lower or raise at a moment's notice. And in some ways, the city was like Venice. They didn't really have many streets, but what they did is they had waterways. So people used to go around the city with canoes and bring goods back to and fro. The core of the city was an island. And on that island, they made massive temples to their gods. And it was alive, it was vibrant. There were markets, there were schools, there was stores, there were eateries. And there was a lot of it. The reason why the Aztecs made the empire was the same reason why the Europeans wanted to build theirs. How much food do you think you grow on a lake? I mean, sure, you can have fish. But are you going to get your produce? Are you going to get your fruits? Are you going to get your vegetables? No. Are you going to get your grains? No. Plus, where are you going to get the wood? Where are you going to get the clothing, the cloth, the fabric? Where are you going to get the meat? This core was kind of like a central hub in which all corners of the empire sent whatever goods it was they produced for the benefit of the rulers, the people. Questions? Now here's something extraordinary. You would think that this means that this system was there for thousands of years. But the truth is actually very far from that reality. We don't know exactly when they first appeared in their homeland. Based on the stories that were told and the way the Spanish interpreted it, it seems that they managed to come into the region, which was a valley, and it would be known as the Valley of Mexica, which is the basis for the country of Mexico, only about the 13th century. Roughly 200, maybe 300 years tops before the Spanish showed up. That's when they first moved there. Then, it seems that they were harassed. They must have been migrants, not quite sure where they came from. They must have been fleeing some type of natural disaster, or maybe other tribes. They came into the valley hoping to get safe haven, but apparently they were harassed by all the other tribes that were there and kind of enslaved. But they showed themselves to be strong, fit, capable warriors. So, a relationship was kind of made in which they would be allowed to live in the valley in exchange for, sorry, I'll come back to that, in exchange for serving the Azkaz Polotska. These were the imperial overlords of the valley when the Aztec came in. And what was the deal? Well, every tribe in the empire had to pay tribute to the rulers in the form of goods and services. So the Aztec came in and they were at the bottom of the ladder. But eventually, their ferocity, their loyalty allowed them to rise in wealth and power and position. Now, by the way the Spanish interpreted the story by the Aztecs was that this was similar to Jehovah calling his people home. They believed that they were blessed by their god, the god of the sky, Huitzilopochtli, who basically blessed them with the land. This was going to be the promised land, and they were the chosen people. And he would watch over them and give them prosperity in exchange for tribute to the gods. 200 years go by. The Aztecs is just one tribe and a big empire. Until 1428, the Aztec chief, Itzcoatl, is fed up with being a subject. He begins making alliances with some of his neighboring tribes, builds an army that's actually stronger than the Azcapotzalco, overthrows them, and seizes the empire. Kind of like a coup d'etat. Less than 100 years before the Spanish arrived is when the Aztec Empire was begun. Of course, we know the American Empire. We've been here for 220 plus years. Actually, almost 250. So, by way of comparison, put us back to the post-Civil War years during Reconstruction, because that's where we were at 100 years. So it was new. It wasn't grand and ancient. And the people who were subjugated still remembered through their oral traditions there was a before time. And that would be key. All right, questions?
Was that island built by them, or was there an island already?
There was a natural island there, and they just started moving and expanding and building. Because think about it. They just did a coup d'etat.
Okay.
So they needed to put themselves in a safe position so they wouldn't get wiped out. Well, in time, they not only conquered their overlords, but they began conquering tribes, going further and further and further away from the core, building a larger, vast, stronger empire. Based on paying tribute, giving something of your own. All right, how did Itzcoatl hold this all together? Well, the Aztecs were clever. They realized the only way that a minority group of people can keep control over large numbers of people was by making the majority forget who they were. So,
he began building an ideology which would become the glue that kind of held the empire together. He, for example, ordered his men to go out and to destroy any records in the valley, in the empire, that predated the emergence of his reign. So basically anything, destroyed. He also began forcing narratives on the people through what we call revisionism. Soon, even the conquered people, when they were born and raised, they only ever knew their place in the Aztec Empire. The Aztec was always there. The people are the rulers. We are the subjects. That's the way it is. He also forced on them the religion. And in the religious narrative, the people are the only ones who can keep the gods satiated, pleased. So the people, the Aztecs, are actually the supermen, the master race. And everyone else is inferior. But they're necessary. Because if they don't keep the gods happy, the gods are going to come down and destroy all existence. So, the people literally were born to believe that they were the subjects of a master race. And it was their job to serve the master race, because the master race serves the gods. Go to 130, right? Or 140? 130. 130. All right. I was off. So the next class starts at 140. I've been doing Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then do the Tuesday, Thursday thing. Brain's not there. All right. Well, I hate to leave us mid-story, but I got to leave you mid-story because I'm not going to keep you late. So, for those of you who were here on Thursday, your homework is, of course, to still go through the book that's on the website, see if you can figure out something you want to write about. I've already approved a couple. They came through on like Friday or Saturday. You're going to send me an email. If you sent me an email yesterday, sorry, I was kind of busy dealing with the weather and stuff. So I will check email tonight or tomorrow, so I'll get back to you. Topics are due by when?
31st.
All right, excellent. And for those of you who are new, come to class. Go on my website, listen to the lecture, understand what's going to come in terms of grades and so forth, all right? If you have any questions, send me an email. Stay warm.